Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELEC 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, a part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. All right, we're going to split this show into two parts, Jeff. We're going to do basketball at the start, talk a little college, and then have Keith Pompey for the Sixers. Then we'll talk with Keith O'Brien about his book, Charlie Hustle, and Pete Rose, and then we'll talk some baseball after that. So give me your thoughts on the NCAA tourney, and hello, by the way.
Hello, by the way. I don't know what the hello, by the way, is. It's not like I didn't see you last week, but I just look, the women's tournament was so much more exciting than the men's tournament. And I'm not taking anything away from UConn, but the fact was, it was almost, I can't remember the time where it was a foregone conclusion. I mean, the reason people did not pick UConn in their brackets is because they figured everybody else was, and they needed to find something else if they wanted to win their bracket.
I picked UConn, but it was the only thing I got right in the bracket. So.
Exactly. I mean, UConn just blew out the competition. And the amazing thing about it is UConn doesn't have a top five pick in next year's NBA draft. They have good players. But they had a great team, and they have a really, really good coach.
Yes.
Who, by the way, you like statistics? Here's a statistic. Do you know Dan Hurley has twice as many NCAA championships as John Pat Calipari?
Wow.
Think about that.
Who had the line of the week, by the way, in his move from Kentucky to Arkansas when he gets to the press conference, and he gets there and he says to the media, "I met with the team. There is no team." Nothing inspires confidence by saying, "I talk to you, you don't exist." But back to the men's tourney, kind of a foregone conclusion. You know, I'm a ratings guy. UConn Purdue, 14.8 million viewers, tiny uptick over last year. But the long-term trend in the last 10 years, down 30%. Now, a lot of that, by the way, is because of cord cutters. They don't air on broadcast TV. They air on cable.
Okay. But that's not what we all care about. So what was the rating for the women's tournament?
The women's game was the highest basketball game, men, women, college, pro, in the last 5 years at 18.9 million viewers. That's a lot of people. That's double the record 9.9 million from last year.
And the Indiana Fever are salivating.
They're already, I think, everything but four games that they have are going to be televised. They started a single game ticket plan for their tickets because so many people want to come see her play. The question is, will the leagues be able to capitalize on this? I feel like the NCAA women's tournament did very well.
Did I not hear that there were some WNBA teams that were moving some of their games to larger arenas?
Yeah, I think it's Las Vegas, the Aces. They're playing at a larger arena for them to play. And look, I mean, it's a great opportunity for the women's game. The women's Final Four viewership was up 114%. It was the most watched Final Four ever. So it's not just, you know, you had great stars, you had great teams, and you had really good coaching. And, you know, you had Dawn Staley and her team ultimately winning it. And the way that she reflects on the sport and the way that they played the game, it was just exciting basketball to watch.
How did Dawn Staley, people should not gloss over what a great coach and what a great person Dawn Staley is. Can Temple find some way
no.
to get her back here? No,
at this point, that's a step down for her. I mean, for her to move,
I think wherever Dawn Staley goes, she's going to build a winner.
I think it's to the NBA eventually. I think that's where she ultimately will get a shot. And she should. Look, years ago, before Nick Nurse, she was the person I talked to about you and said I would pick her here. Absolutely. Where does women's sports go from this? Do you think they can continue this growth now that they have more eyeballs? You're seeing it translated to the WNBA. I still would love to see a women's team here in Philly. Can't believe that we're a sports city that doesn't have a WNBA.
I'm going to tell you, as much as we all worry about what the negative impacts are of NIL, I'm going to make an argument for you of how NIL is helping women's sports, because it's getting women athletes at the college level more visibility earlier on, and it's convincing. If I were an advertiser, it would now be convincing me that you're able to sell the sport and those athletes, which then makes it easier to convince them to put money into their pro sports, advertise their pro sports, and get them on TV and get them on streaming services at higher prices.
So that's my
argument that NIL has been more impactful in a positive way on the women's game and games than it is on the men's games.
On the men's side, I feel like the tournament is basically an interview for the portal at this point. Like, your team loses after you get exposure in the tournament and you enter the portal because you got this exposure. So, like, it's hard. You watch the game, and we'll talk later. You know, we've talked Rutgers before. Rutgers has a bunch of people coming in, but their whole team is gone. Like, everybody's in the portal. Now, they'll have a very good basketball team next year, but you're getting to, you have to root for the name on the front because you don't know the name on the back at this point sometimes.
Yeah, it's, you know, I went all positive and you had to go negative.
Oh,
so I'm not even
going to
comment on your negativity. I'll save it for when we do 6 or 7.
Why don't we go to Keith and I'll let you balance out the negativity. And then when we come back, we'll talk some more baseball. All right, let's get ready for the weekend. Huge game tonight in South Philly. Keith Pompey, let's bring him on. Do you think I'd be saying that about a month ago, that there'd be a huge game in South Philly?
Maybe it was the Flyers, or if it was like maybe a high school team playing in South Philly, you know what I mean? But no, I mean, you know, right now, if you looked at it about a month ago, Joel Embiid wasn't playing. The Sixers looked like they were the second coming of the process. I mean, if you're going to be real, they were struggling. They looked like a lottery team. And then all of a sudden, you know, Joel comes back and then there's like new life in the team. So no, you wouldn't have said that a month ago, but this is a huge game against, the Orlando Magic led by Michigan's Franz Wagner.
Franz Wagner, Mo Wagner, Caleb Houston, Jet Howard, half the team went to Michigan.
For our listeners, Keith put Jeff on the defensive calling out Michigan before we started this interview.
We can't say that those words.
So Jeff is Jeff is in defensive mode rather than let's talk about the Sixers mode. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I just think this is my own commentary before I ask a question. I think it's sad that we've gotten to this point in the city that the huge game is whether or not we can make it out of the knockout round of the playoffs. Not huge game because we might win the division, huge game because we might lock up a top seed. This is whether we don't have to play in the play-in. The question is, okay, let's assume that the Sixers get into the play-in. I would say they're going to make it out of that. And then they're stuck playing either the Celtics or the Bucks. Is this going to be a first? Let's assume that it's the Bucks. Do they have a puncher's chance against the Bucks?
You know what? I think they do just because of – here's the problem with the Bucks. You know,
Doc
the Bucks
Rivers?
Defensive – well, I mean, some people may say that. But I also think that, you know, Dame Lillard has been getting attacked a lot on the defensive end, right? You have the Greek freak Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's been playing extremely well just to try to keep this team afloat. The problem is he has a messed up ankle right about now. So if whoever gets them early may have a puncher's chance, right? And mm-hmm. and I don't think that, to be honest with you, I think the New York Knicks at this particular time of the season are better than the Bucks. You know, I do. I think the Knicks are. But I think there are several teams in the league, like the Bucks, for instance, that's a little suspect. I mean, since Doc Rivers been the coach, they've been 17-17. I think the Cleveland Cavaliers are suspect. I think that Cleveland has shown us the previous two seasons that they're a way better regular season team than they are a playoff. They don't take that next level up. And I think that's the reason why there's some optimism with the 76ers, just because it's kind of like the teams ahead of them are kind of sort of like on a downward spiral, besides the Knicks and the Boston Celtics, who have been taking a week off, right? But that's why the optimism is. And the Bucks, you know, I'm not a big believer in them. Maybe they can turn it on, But I'm just not a big believer in the Milwaukee Bucks at this particular time.
Well, and they want to
just got a. I got a Bucks follow up.
Okay.
Okay. So before the season started, and Drew Holiday went to the Celtics, and Dame Lillard came to the Bucks, we sat here on the air and said, "I don't get it." Drew Holiday is one of the best players in the NBA on both sides of the ball. He's a complete player, and he adds a tenacity. Are the Bucks better now than they were last season?
They're worse, man. They're worse. And see, what happens is you get in the panic mode a little bit. Like, and I get it. They choked in the first round of playoffs. I get that. But then all of a sudden, you decide that you got to go star hunting. And that's where, and I love Dame Lillard, I really do. But that's where star hunting goes wrong, because you got rid of a guy who not only is a solid offensive player, a guy who can play both guard positions, but he's one of the league's top defenders in the Eastern Conference when you need a guy who can guard opposing guards. And that's where they messed up at. Like, so it's like, yes, you got Dame Lillard, who is a scorer, but now you're asking him to be a secondary scorer, which isn't a role that he's used to, right? So he has to play off of Giannis. But you gave up a guy who was a great distributor, a guy who was a great defender, and a guy who fit in well as a third or fourth scoring option. So, yeah, you got the superstar, but you lost team depth. You lost a lot of different things. So, no, they're not a better team. And they're not a better team after they made the trade, and after they fired the coach either.
You talk about team depth. I don't know that this is the best starting five the Sixers have had in the era since this process, but I think this is the deepest team that they've had in terms of options. You got thoughts on that? And what is the rotation for this team now going into the playoffs?
Yeah, you know, it's weird because, you know, I'm not 100% sure if this is the deepest team that they had, like, right now. I honestly feel like before the trade deadline that this team was a little bit deeper. I do. And you know, on paper, it sounds good. But, you know, we got to realize a guy like KJ Martin, who's been getting a lot of minutes, fourth quarter minutes as of late, was getting a lot of DMPs before the trade deadline. You know, we look at Buddy Hield. You know, Buddy Hield had probably three, maybe five quality games. Four of those quality games came in the beginning of after he was traded, right? So then the last one was against the Detroit Pistons. So I think there's some holes there. Now, you talk about a starting lineup, right? Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
You know, right now, I know there's a lot of people saying we got to get Nico Batum in the starting lineup. There's some people saying we got to go with De'Anthony Melton over Kyle Lowry. But right now, if the playoff starts next week, I mean, the starting lineup that I'm going to have, and Jeff is looking at me like I'm crazy, but the starting lineup that I'm going to have is Kyle Lowry, is, what's his name? Joel Embiid.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey, Kelly Oubre, and Tobias Harris. And the reason why I'm saying that is because De'Anthony Melton is only a couple games back. I don't know how many minutes he can give you, right? And also, if he's healthy, he could play more minutes than Kyle, right, if he's healthy. Mm-hmm. Secondly, but you also need leadership. Secondly, I think that Tobias, a lot of people are saying you got to get rid of him, get him out of the starting lineup. I don't think that that's wise at this stage. I feel like you can lose that player. If he struggles in the game, yeah, you know, Nico, you're going to get the bulk of the minutes. But I feel like you got to go with Tobias. You have to. I honestly do.
All right. I asked the question about the Bucks. I'll ask the questions about the Sixers. Are the Sixers better this year than they were last year with Harden?
See, I'm trying to think back to everybody they had. You know, I think that's a loaded question because I feel
that's
like
what Jeff does to you. Welcome to the show,
I mean,
Keith.
I feel like you know, to be honest, I feel like when Embiid is playing, with Embiid's playing, I feel like Kelly Oubre is kind of like a better fit for them because you have someone, as long as you got Kyle Lowry and Kelly Oubre, I feel like they're better fits to play with Embiid because you have Kyle who can orchestrate where people are going, and then you have Kelly who can move without the ball and be aggressive. Now, if Embiid is hurt and Embiid's not playing to the level that we think he should play to, then you got to give me James Harden because James Harden is able to get himself buckets and get others buckets. But the problem with the James and I feel like the James and Joel Embiid pairing is that it becomes too much of a two-man game, right? And other people are just standing around, if that makes sense to you. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it gets to a point where guys get, they don't get the ball, they don't get the rock. Remember what Doc Rivers said, this is not a democracy. So then what happens is when those two guys start struggling, then they start looking around at the other people and saying, y'all didn't help. Well, they're like, we didn't get any plays ran for us. It's like, you know, it's like 3 seconds left in the shot clock and you're throwing the ball to me and expect me to do a catch and shoot. So, you know, it's kind of like a loaded question. And if I didn't answer your question, I'm sorry, but I feel like they're better if Joel's healthy. If Joel isn't, then you got to ride with James.
All right. I'll ask you another loaded question then. Are they better off with Nick Nurse than they were with Doc Rivers now?
Oh, come on. That's not even loaded.
Okay. To you, asking you that question is a waste of time.
Keith,
asking
please.
Him that question may not be a waste of time. Keith,
you know, here's the bad part. Here's the thing I will say this about. I think that Nick Nurse is a better in-game coach. I think that Doc Rivers is more of a CEO, so to speak, right? But I think Nick Nurse makes some adjustments. I think Nick's Nurse could do less, do more with less. Now, with that being said, I also feel like if Joel Embiid and James Harden would have played better, then Doc Rivers would have probably, everybody would have been raving over him for getting the Sixers out of the second round. But they didn't play. But I do think that Nick Nurse is a better coach than Doc Rivers. Yes, I do. I do.
You mentioned somebody a little bit back, Kelly Oubre, came here on a minimum deal. It seems like he's making an impact on each game now, even the minutes that he gets. The thing that I like is he's not afraid of the shot. Like, he doesn't pass it up. He'll go aggressive. He doesn't mind the contact. What role is he going to play here in the playoffs? Where is he off coming off the bench?
I think he's starting.
You think he's starting?
I think Kelly Oubre is going to start. Like, I mean, right now, you look at Tobias Harris, and Tobias Harris is you know, listed as the third best player on the team, and he is. But I think that as of late, Kelly Oubre may have been the third most consistent player on the team behind Joel Embiid, behind Maxey, and this and that. So I feel like Kelly is going to play a vital role. Now, here's the thing about Kelly. Like you said, the thing that I like about him is, yes, his defense is better. But Kelly is a guy who's mastered how to stay involved in the game without any plays being called for him. He's always active. He's crashing the boards. He's doing a lot of things. And the one thing that some people may say about Kelly is like, man, he's always shooting the ball. Well, that aggressive nature that he has enabled him to be able to fit in so well and take up the slack when the other two guys are having off games, and especially while Tobias Harris has been struggling. So, you know, right now you look at Kelly. Kelly has been the third most consistent scorer for the Sixers as of late, surpassing Tobias. So, to me, you need to keep him in the starting lineup.
I wanted to ask real fast about health. Covington, not sure about him. Melton's obviously back. Let's see if he holds up. And Maxey's missed games here and there with different sorenesses. How's everybody feeling going into the playoffs? It's the healthiest I've seen Joel Embiid on a court in a long time. What's this team's health going in?
You know, it's pretty good. I mean, the thing about Cove, you the question you have about Cove is like, you know, hey, what's up with his knee? Because he has a bone bruise. Tobias Harris had a bone bruise. Tobias missed three games. You know what I mean? Cubs been out since December the 30th. So is it worse than what you're saying it was?
Yes.
Because it's bad. And so the deal is I don't see Cub. You know, you asked if he practiced. I asked Nick if he practiced yesterday. Did he do anything? Like, nope. Right. But the health, I'm not going to say it's the healthiest the team has been in a while, because, you know, typically you still have Tyrese Maxey playing like with a hip impingement, so to speak. Tobias Harris has a banged up knee. You know, Kyle Lowry has a banged up knee. But this is the NBA, where a lot of guys, they go through things and they play through the pain. So it's good to say that they had stuff. But, you know, the thing is, I think in the past, it's always been Joel. Other guys have been healthy. You know what I mean? At least they weren't listed on a depth chart. I mean, excuse me, on the injury list. So, you know, we'll see, man. We'll see. It all sounds good. But then whenever something happens, then we always get that excuse. Well, you know, the guy was banged. Playing with a banged up knee.
Well, does it really matter? I mean, I hate to be.
Oh my God, you are
here.
So Debbie Downer.
I'm asking the question. Okay, the Celtics were really good last year, and they added Jrue Holiday. Can anybody in the East really keep up with them in a 7-game playoff?
I mean, if they come to play, no. If they come to play. Now, what I saw last night.
They got boat race last night.
Yeah, they got boat.
I still don't understand that term, but sometimes somebody's going to have to explain it to me.
Keith, send him the video you posted last night of the two boats.
And you guys see how they
Jeff doesn't understand that saying. Basically, Celtics had a different start time for the game last night than the Knicks did, it appeared.
Yeah, it's like it was ugly. I mean, dude, it was ugly. Now, the only thing worse than the Celtics starters' performance was the Knicks bench, because they almost blew a 30-point lead. It was horrible, man. It was like, whoa, if they had played three more minutes, it would have been like, dang, they lost by five. That's how bad the bench was, right? Am I lying?
No, but do you, I mean, look, at this point, if you can get rest, you get rest.
They were playing, though.
That's I know they're playing, play. they're keeping loose, but I don't think anybody, they don't, at this point, they just need to get to the playoffs. For them, that's what this is all about. The next games, so what?
Yeah, but the quick thing is, we got to see what the coaching is like, too. I mean, I do agree with you. They look great. They're the team to beat. If they stay healthy in the playoffs, I do expect them to go to the finals. But at the same time, I think that there's going to be a lot of different schemes thrown at them and things like that. And other guys are going to, less heralded guys are going to have to step up. But my main concern with the Celtics is the coach. You know, last year in the playoffs, I mean, you've seen it, like, you know, when they finally made an adjustment is when they won the game. But before, won the series. But before that, it was no adjustments being made. There were no adjustments being made in the Eastern Conference Finals, which led to them losing. You know, so to me, now he does have Sam Cassell and other people on his bench. So we got to see what they do. But they are the team to beat. But at the same time, we remember a couple of years ago, the Golden State Warriors won, 70-plus games and didn't win the championship. So anything can happen. I mean, I think coaching is going to be key in the postseason.
Well, you mentioned it there. It's the first time in years, you know, I was never a Doc fan, so we'll just get that out there again. It's the first time in years I feel like the Sixers actually have a coaching advantage in-game in terms of somebody who will make adjustments, who can draw up end-of-game plays. You saw that a few nights ago where Nico Batum had the inbound pass to Tyrese Maxey to force the overtime. Doc Rivers doesn't draw up that play. I'm sorry. It just doesn't happen in-game there like that from what we saw during his time as a Sixers. So talk about the coaching matchups in the East, not the players on the court, the coaches that are there in some of these matchups. Am I wrong to feel more comfortable that I finally have a coach that will make adjustments in game based on what's going on the court?
Yeah, I mean, no, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. But at the same time, I do think that there are some pretty good coaches. Like, I think the Orlando Magic's coach is probably a guy who doesn't get the just due respect that he deserves.
That's because nobody knows who he is.
Well, I mean, yeah, no one knows who he is. But, like, let me tell you this. You look at this team, and you see how the problem is they got such a young team, and they play hard in the regular season, and they did everything that now it's kind of like, okay, the bullets are getting real. So let's see if you guys can elevate. But yes, he's a great coach. Nick Nurse does make some great adjustments. But the thing is, I also think that it's also a players' league too. I mean, think about this. If as much as like Pat Riley was a great coach, as much as Greg Popovich is a great coach, I mean, all these guys had Hall of Famers with them. Like, you know, it's Red Auerbach. You know what I mean, dude? Come on, man. Like, so I think that even with Nick Nurse, when he won the championship, he had Kawhi, right? He had Marc Gasol. He had all these other guys, which he is a great coach, and I'm not knocking him. But I also think that, you know, if he was doing this with a G League roster, it wouldn't matter. You know what I mean? Like Tyrese Maxey still had to make that shot. Whatchamacallit, you know, Nico Batum is a reason why even when he's slated to be off, they dress him just so he can do an inbounds. Like, because, you know, it's like they don't have anyone else to do it. But yeah, he's a better coach than Doc. I'll give you that. You know, I give you that. He makes great plays. But see, the only thing, and I'm drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit. But the only thing that concerns me about my drinking the Kool-Aid is that the teams that they defeated recently weren't that good. Like they defeated the Detroit Pistons, and they were on cruise control. And they needed double overtime to beat the Spurs. So to me, there's two ways you can look at it. You look at it and you say to yourself, a heck of a win. Tyrese Maxey dropped 52 to beat the Spurs. Or you can look at it and say, man, without Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey needed 52 to take this to beat the Spurs in double overtime. So it all sounds good and we're all excited, but, you know, and then one thing I will say, they did beat Miami on the road. They did beat Oklahoma City, but these last two games, that's why this game tonight is so important against Orlando, because it's a quality opponent and the game means something. But to me, that's the only thing that makes me a little nervous is that some of these teams, because let's face it, the Sixers, you know, the Sixers got the easiest schedule. Like the last seven games is the easiest schedule in the NBA.
From what you said, you just mentioned the Spurs from your observations of Victor Wembanyama and Chet Holmgren, who gets Rookie of the Year?
Victor.
He's insane. Some of the things he does on the court just shouldn't be humanly possible. It's amazing.
I mean, you know, the thing about Chet is good, but Chet also has Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on his team who, in my opinion, needs to get more credit for the MVP race, right? Because, like, if you take him off that team, and I know Chet was a number two pick, but it's Shai and a bunch of dudes, right? I mean, like, who are they? You know what I mean? Like, who are they? So you look at Victor, and I get it. Like, Wembanyama, his team is struggling. But there's a lot of G League guys on that team. You know, a lot. Like, they have Caden Johnson, who's been injured for most of the year. He came back, and he played. You know, Charles Bassey was the backup center, getting a lot of minutes, and then he got injured. So it was weird. Like, they had to literally sign people and just for, like, to fill out the roster. Like, they brought up a lot of guys in the G League. So don't know. It's Victor to me.
And you think Shai should be the MVP or just should get more credit for it? I mean, if you take him off that team versus taking Jokic off of Nuggets.
You know, I'm going back and forth. Like, you know, you know, Jokic is, I think Jokic is kind of like LeBron, Jordan, where he can win the award annually. You know what I mean? But then you say, and the reason why I'm going back and forth, because he's putting up these phenomenal numbers and he's the easy pick. But then if you take Shai off that team, is that team one of the top three teams in the West? I don't think so.
Who do you think comes out of the West?
Huh?
Who do you think comes out of the West?
Denver. I do. I think Denver has the best team. I mean, they do, you know, and I know they lost people last year, but I still think they have the best team. You know, I think, you know, quietly they got arguably, I don't know, they got the best player. And they also, like, you know, got some pretty good co-stars as well. You know, I think, and I also think, you know, that altitude thing means a lot. It's tough to go in there and win. It's tough to go in there and win. I mean, I think Denver will come out of the West. But then, you know, but the thing is, we talk about it. That's how some people project. And again, I haven't decided yet. I got to look at the numbers and everything and look and see how they did. But a lot of people, you know, last year, a lot of people went after Joel Embiid. And then they saw what Nikola Jokic did in the playoffs. And they're like, oh, we messed up. So we got to switch it. And then they're thinking, they're projecting on how Denver's going to do, as opposed to seeing where OKC came from and where they are now, you know? So again, like, and I'm not, it may seem like I'm leaning towards Shai right now, but I'm not. I just got to sit down and look at things before I make my pick.
You know, you mentioned the difficulty with going with the altitude. When you're there writing a story, is it a little harder for you to write the story because of the altitude?
not the right story.
But the things you want to say to him now, you can't say on the air. And I understand.
Well, no, I only have one more question. How'd Pitt do in the NCAA tournament this year?
Shots fired.
I tell you what, they would have boat raced Michigan.
Actually, you're right. And the hard part about ending an interview like this is that I went to Pitt for law school.
But can I ask you a question?
I have to talk smack against my own school just to get.
Can I ask you a question? Honestly, who has a better basketball team and a brighter future, Michigan or Rutgers?
Go ahead, Jeff. Say it. Spit it out.
Michigan.
Oh, come on.
If you're talking future as far as 2024.
I'm talking about next year, immediate future.
Oh, next year, Rutgers. Long-term, Michigan.
You think so? I think y'all done, man.
All right. You said that about it.
I think y'all going to go back to being a football and swimming school.
Keith Pompey, follow at Pompey on Sixers in the Inquirer. Let's see what the Sixers can do tonight, and hopefully they'll give us something exciting so that Jeff will actually think it's an interesting, real basketball game that we could cheer for. Thanks for the time, man.
All right. Thanks, y'all.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains, and the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
New York Times bestselling author, award-winning journalist Keith O'Brien joins the show. Let's talk about his new book on the rise and fall of Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith, you're in the Midwest now on your tour. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Yes, I'm speaking to you today from Cincinnati, Ohio, of all places.
This is, you're from Cincinnati, so you grew up on Pete Rose. But I don't know if that's why you chose Pete and why you chose now. You've said that this is kind of a Shakespearean tragedy. Talk to us about why Pete and why now.
So I think in the last 35 years, as Pete has been banned from baseball and has made mistake after mistake off the field, I think we have forgotten who he really is, or who he once was, or why we ever cared in the first place. And the fact is, you know, Pete Rose looms over baseball and still looms at times over American culture because he was an American icon. And, you know, what I wanted to do with the book was go back and tell that story, the story of this epic rise, because we only care about the fall that is also in the book because of the rise, because we ever cared about Pete in the first place. And so I wanted to look at his story through the prism of history, tell that story with unprecedented access and reporting, write it and let people come to their own conclusions. Because, you know, I think, you know, especially in recent years in America, you know, Pete Rose has become like a political party. You know, you either support him or you don't support him. But how we got here, I think, is interesting.
You know, the book is interesting because of what you said. We've lost sight of the Pete Rose, the baseball player. There's now a whole generation of people that only know Pete Rose, the gambler. And when reading your book, you come across the fact that Pete Rose himself was a real success story. He was not this great athlete, even though he has the most hits in history. What was the most interesting thing that you came across about Pete Rose's struggle to become the baseball player that he was?
So in my reporting, I tried to obviously further the story. And if I ever cracked open the door to a room, say, that we, the reader, we, the fan, had never been in before, that's a room I want to linger in. And in my reporting, I started interviewing men who played baseball with Pete on the west side of Cincinnati, where he was born and raised, in the 1940s and 50s. So these are guys who were Pete Rose's age. They're also 81, 82, 83 years old. And, you know, in those interviews, I met many folks and got a photograph of Pete Rose's 1956 city champion baseball team. And it's a stunning photo because Pete Rose looks like he could be the little brother of the kids on the team, his teammates. He looks like he could be the bat boy on this team full of teenagers. He is so small, and why that matters is that, you know, because of his size, he wasn't very strong. His hits didn't go very far. He was known for being scrappy, and this whole persona of Charlie Hustle begins with him long before he's ever given that nickname. He knows, even in that photograph that I have that's in the book, that you know, he's got to play harder than the other kids in that photograph because he's simply not as talented as the kids standing around him.
Can you talk about, you know, Pete gets to the majors and he has a success story, and then he's in the middle, as you talk about, so many formidable moments in the history of baseball during his time playing. I think you've said on his legacy, no matter how you feel, you can write the history of baseball. You can't write the history of baseball without Pete Rose in the 20th century. Talk to us about how he finds himself at the middle of everything.
So, you know, part of it's accident and part of it's the kind of thing that happens with a guy like Pete Rose. You know, these were some of the true glory years of baseball. And I want to be clear about that subtitle on my book. I'm not pining nostalgic for these days. I'm simply saying the crowds, the television audiences, the size of baseball in our consciousness at the time are all massive. And the game is still unpolished. It's this rough and tumble thing. And Pete Rose, you know, in many cases brings that rough and tumble mentality. You know, you've got several iconic moments that unfold, and he's right in the middle of it. You know, the collision at home plate to end the 1970 All-Star Game, that collision between Pete Rose and Ray Fosse, a moment that defines both men. Multiple World Series with the Reds and the Phillies, those great big red machine teams. His 44-game hit streak in 1998, which is, by the way, a hit streak we haven't seen the likes of since 1978. And then, of course, the chase for the all-time hit record, which, you know, was so iconic at the time that I would submit that if you were alive that night in 1985 and you were watching, you remember exactly where you were. And it's not going to happen again. You know, the current major league leader, active leader in hits to start this season was Freddie Freeman, a great player. Freddie Freeman has 2,115 hits to start the season. He's 34 years old. Even if Freddie Freeman were to average over the next decade the same amount of hits he's averaged over the last 3 years at the peak of his career, he would still come up short. He would not break the all-time hit record. It is simply not happening.
So talk to us about the other side of his legacy. You've also said he's a cautionary tale because he had it all and was a beloved icon, and it was his choices that threw it away. So let's talk about the fall in 1989.
One of the things I did in the narrative, you know, aside from sketching out this rise and this fall, is to note and leave breadcrumbs along the way. Because, you know, it's not, you know, Pete Rose doesn't go down in 1989 for something he did on a whim 3 weeks or 3 months earlier or something he did once. You know, this is a lifetime of gambling, a lifetime of poor decisions that's going to come to a head around 1987 and then finally make it to the front office of Major League Baseball 2 years later. So, one thing that the book does is show how Pete got into gambling and why he got into gambling and how he was initially doing it, you know, gambling with bookies who were just other good time guys on the west side of Cincinnati, family friends, effectively, the neighborhood bookie, the kind of guy who would let someone like Pete Rose carry a debt and not come after him for it. But, you know, my reporting shows clearly that by 1975, even during the epic 1975 World Series between the Red Sox and the Reds, it's already a concern in the Reds dugout and clubhouse about Pete's relationships with gamblers. By 1978, based on my reporting, there is some kind of intervention that happens in Cincinnati. Before a game at Riverfront Stadium, there is some kind of meeting between Pete Rose and officials from Major League Baseball to discuss his gambling. And then it only grows worse into the 1980s. So there's an open secret. The open secret is ignored or buried, but it cannot be buried forever. And you're right, based on his own decisions, his own choices, and really his own addictions, Pete Rose is going to go down.
Well, that, you know, you used the word addiction, and in this context with addiction to gambling, did you come away from this, the people that you talked to, especially the investigators and the people he played against, thinking that this was truly just an addiction, or was this a situation where Pete Rose enjoyed being around surly figures?
Great question. You know, I did an interview once with a man named Jerry Carroll, prominent businessman in the Midwest, made a lot of money and made his name building and running racetracks. And Jerry Carroll loved Pete Rose, and they would often spend the night together at the track, Jerry's tracks. But Jerry told me that one of his big concerns about Pete, and I'm talking mid-1980s, I'm talking before the fall, is that Pete seemed to surround himself with guys who were willing to do whatever Pete wanted to do. And I don't know what that says about Pete Rose. And Jerry Carroll didn't know what it said either. You know, this was a man who could have hung out with anybody, Pete Rose. But he chooses to hang out with young admirers who are really caught in the spotlight of Pete Rose's fame, want to stay in that spotlight, are willing to do anything to do that. And Pete often used these men to place his bets with bookies and then to place his bets on baseball. And I do think that that is the behavior of an addict. He was surrounding himself with people who were happy to aid and abet him in his addiction. And, like many addicts, P. Rose has struggled over the years to really speak honestly about what was happening at that time. He's contradicted himself at times about whether or not he was ever really addicted. But in my interviews with the people who were in that inner circle, who had a front row seat to Pete's gambling in the 1970s and 80s, every single one of them said that he was horribly addicted to gambling and there was nothing that they could do to stop it.
Pete thought he would still be able to get into the Hall of Fame, even accepting this punishment. And Bart Giamani had said he looked forward to seeing how they judged life and art. And you kind of look at that in the book, sort of, are we looking at people's lives and the way they lived or the art that they created? Can you just talk about how things changed for Pete after he accepted the punishment?
This is a key point, and I think it's been forgotten by most baseball fans. I'll be honest, I had forgotten this part of the story before I got into it. In 1989, when Pete accepts his banishment, and it's important to point out that he does, he signs a document agreeing to it. He knows full well that his name is going to appear on the ballot at Cooperstown 2 years later in 1991, 5 years removed from his last at bat as a player. And I think there's a very good likelihood that Pete gets elected if that's the case. But in early 1991, 10 months before his name will appear on the ballot, the National Baseball Hall of Fame changes the rules. And they now state that only eligible players can be placed on the ballot. It's effectively the Pete Rose corollary because he is ineligible. And writers at the time, the voters, are angry. And not just because they wanted to vote for him. You know, some write entire columns complaining about the rule change because for the very first time, the Hall of Fame has basically pre-screened a player out of the pool of official voters of players. And you know, I understand why it happens. As one writer notes at the time, if Pete Rose is on the ballot, it could destroy the Hall of Fame because he was essentially at war with baseball over the key allegations in the final report. But Sparky Anderson, the Hall of Fame manager for the Reds, said something that winter, right when this rule change was imposed, that I think has turned out to be true. Sparky said it was a mistake. If for no other reason, he said it was a mistake. Because now that we wouldn't be able to vote on it, this question about Pete Rose was going to loom over baseball forever. And no matter how you feel about Pete Rose, Sparky was right about that. Because 35 years later, it does still loom over baseball.
We know you have to go, but before you go, to me, the most interesting thing that I wanted an answer to from your book is, does Pete Rose see himself as a victim? Or does he now accept responsibility and realize what he did?
I'm going to give an answer that sounds crazy and contradictory all at once. It's both. You know, Pete Rose, in his mind, has apologized and apologized again and again. And so he believes he has come clean. And yet he does all too often, you know, paint himself as a victim or quibble with pieces of the investigation in 1989. Even the title of his book, his memoir that he wrote in 2004, in which he for the first time admitted that he was lying all these years and he had bet on baseball, you know, paints him as a victim. You know, My Prison Without Bars is the title of that book. So both are true. And what I have hopefully tried to do in this book is paint a portrait of this man, who at one time was the center of not just the baseball universe, but the sporting universe in America, and in many ways still is. And again, whether you like baseball or not, whether you root for Pete Rose or not, I think at the end of the day, this is just a compelling story of a man.
We didn't even have time to get to Shohei, which makes this the perfect time for the book to come out. Maybe we'll get you back sometime. The book is Charlie Hustle. It's available everywhere now. As you go on your tour around the country, you can learn more at keithob.com. Keith, best of luck with the book, and thanks for the time to talk about it all.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation, guys.
I really enjoyed that book with Keith O'Brien, and kind of alluded to it. We barely even got to the impact on the current game with Shohei Ohtani. So your thoughts on the book, and then your thoughts on the craziness of the Shohei story that advanced this week.
The book is great. Look, I'm Pete Rose out, and I thought the book was good. Like I'm one of those people who has a very strong opinion of Pete Rose. I think that Pete Rose did something that was the cardinal sin in baseball, in sports. And I thought his arrogance and his dishonesty and his continued dishonesty in ways just to make money, and his flip-flopping in order to make money, and his continued selling his soul the way that he does, and his behavior, I don't have any sympathy for him more than almost anybody in professional sports. Ohtani is a whole different story because I don't really understand the facts as they come out, and they're now court records. So, but I just don't understand how, if it's true that his interpreter went to his financial advisors and told them Shohei wants you to turn off notifications, it doesn't make any sense to me that they said okay without having him there and without having anything signed. Now, I haven't heard. Has he also forged signatures? Because if he hasn't.
Apparently, he was trying to, and Mizuhara initially was rejected from accessing the account when he claimed he was Ohtani trying to wire cash for a car note, but was able to unlock the account by answering security questions. And the accountants and financial advisors employed by Ohtani told investigators that the interpreter told them the account was used for private and despite their concerns about possibly having tax issues.
Okay, so, well, but here's the problem. I know lots of people in the financial industry, and all the protections that are put in place and the way that human beings in those that industry are supposed to handle things. You are not supposed to handle a multi-million dollar account by an interpreter saying something not in the presence of Ohtani. Now, if Ohtani's in the room with the financial advisor, or they're on a Zoom call or whatever, and they see him, and Ohtani says something in Japanese, and the interpreter falsely represents what Ohtani says, I could see the financial advisors going, oh, well, he said it in front of me. What else? I don't know Japanese. What am I supposed to do? But if Mizuhara decided to do this and Ohtani was not present and they didn't see any of this stuff, then somebody should have followed up with him and said, hey, by the way, this is the request. We want to confirm it. Can you just sign this?
You have to read, you're a court documents guy, and so yeah, you'll enjoy reading this. Ipe placed more than 19,000 bets between late 2021 and January of this year, averaging more than $12,000 per bet. He won $140 million, which is great. The only problem is he lost $180 million. And in the court documents, we were very close to the bookie confronting Shohei. Shohei was out walking his dog, and Ipe was ducking him over the money and texted Ipe and said, I see Shohei. It says victim A in the complaint. Mm. Well, and so, like, we were very close to the bookie going to Shohei Ohtani about it. Now, still lots of questions, but a couple minutes left. We'll let that story continue to play itself out. You are going to be... Go ahead.
So I let it percolate for a week as opposed to reacting.
Yes.
And so I'm going to ask you first, do you love, do you hate, do you have... opinion in between on the Philly City Connect jerseys?
Not a fan. It's fine. You'll be down there tonight to see it. I don't hate it as much as I disliked it when they first came out, and I'll probably like it better when they're wearing them. I like the powder blues. That's my thing. And I don't like the font in particular on this, particularly the numbers on the back. I'm just not a fan of it. But you'll get an up close look at it tonight.
I don't like them.
Well, you don't like anything.
No, that's not true. I like the powder blue jerseys a lot.
You don't like that, the Sixers' chances. You don't like the Phillies' jerseys.
But when you, if you're going to call them City Connect jerseys, it's supposed to connect with the city, the heart of the city. And the color of the flag is not the heart of the city.
If I take a microphone
and walk around the city and ask them what color the flag is in Pennsylvania or Philadelphia, I can guarantee you almost nobody knows it.
So it's not just
connecting with anybody.
It's not just because I'm from South Jersey that I didn't know that's the flag color. You're saying people in the city don't know that's the flag color.
Look, they fly the flag in the stadium. And if you said, where's the, and played Where's Waldo and said, by the way, the Pennsylvania city flag is in there. Some people would say, well, they're usually in the outfield. But most people wouldn't even know which one it was.
Well, up until last night, we were playing Where's Waldo with Where's the Extra Base Hit for the Phillies. They had like 19 singles in a row or something like that, busted out last night. They're 7-6 now, above 500. The good thing, the rotation. I mean, the Phillies' starting rotation is a 2.74 ERA through their first 13 games. Their overall rotation as a 3.69 ERA.
Yeah, and they've done this by bringing in somebody who is kind of a restart project, who seems look very good through his first two games, and they also have Taiwan Walker, who hopefully will come back in a month or two, and some bullpen people who are going to be coming back. So the Phillies are good, and by the way, sad thing to see Connor Brogdon go, because as much as people want to give him a shot now, 2 years ago he was integral to that run to the World Series.
You know who's really played a lot better to start the season? Brandon Marsh. Moved up to 6 in the lineup. I mean, he leads the Phils with 4 home runs. He's just really playing well and good baseball right now. It gives you the entree for you to give me the Logan Ohapi report for the week, because I texted you last week with a Logan Ohapi update and a wrestling update. And you rejected the wrestling update that Jason Kelsey had appeared, told me not to send you that ever again, and got upset that ESPN and other sports were treating wrestling as legitimate. But then
predicting the outcome.
But then told me that Logan Ohapi updates were always welcome.
It makes no sense to me that a sports app is predicting the outcomes of a pre-predicted outcome. It doesn't make any sense. That's like saying that I'm going to predict the outcome of a movie.
You all think Jeff gets grumpy on the show. Imagine when I send him like wrestling text message updates. He wasn't having any of it.
But just know, Logan Ohapi is batting over 300 right now. Already has a home run, 4 RBIs, and playing great behind the plate.
I'm glad that you could give us that update. Any final thoughts?
Sixers with a big win versus Orlando, and the city goes crazy.
In the huge game tonight, Jeff. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.